Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. This is March 10th. My goodness, this year is going by fast. And today it's our public hearing on House Bill 5030. And Department of Human Services with Children, Adults, and Families. I've got to get used to our new definitions. And I know that with us this morning is Ramona there. And I'm just for some housekeeping items, if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, would you please turn it off so that it doesn't interrupt the proceedings. And also we have with us Rosie, our piggy bank, and Rosie is very grateful if you use acronyms or the alphabet soup, because Rosie likes to collect dollars that will be given to Oregon Food Bank at the close of session to help to feed the hungry. So on the one hand, and Senator Margaret Carter is our sergeant at arms, and she's very good at pointing out when those acronyms. Yes. So, and we'll be waiting. We don't know why the House members aren't here yet, but I'm sure that I know Senator Bates was in. Reverend Bates was in Portland, where he had a speaking engagement, and he's en route back to Salem. But we will go ahead and welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Buckley, and I'm the acting administrator for self-sufficiency and child safety for Department of Human Resources. And I'd like to essentially wrap up or kind of summarize the TANF program, Temporary Assistance to Needy Family presentation, that I think where we left off. But prior to that, I wanted to suggest a little bit of an organizational issue for us. We have three smaller programs, emergency assistance, refugee program, and prevention services that are presented next in the written material. And we would like to suggest, if we could, that we not have essentially pass over a direct discussion of those programs, but be available for questions so that we could move on to the child welfare issues next, in order to kind of bring things up, to try to get things up to in terms of timing.
At some point, we'll be talking about emergency assistance a little later.
Madam Chair, I believe once we finish the TANF program report, if members have questions, you could ask them of the agency.
Madam Chair, we're happy to answer any questions around either refugee emergency assistance or prevention services.
Okay. Madam Chair.
All right.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Mr. Buckley, I would just ask that if there is something significant happening within the refugee assistance program that you think we should be aware of, please draw that out for us.
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley. Essentially, no. I think things are pretty much on track for the way the program has been operated this biennium. It'll expect to be operated next biennium. Numbers of refugees being resettled in Oregon have dropped, but we project a steady number. We don't anticipate any major shifts in the way the refugee program is operated.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Buckley, that would be of some importance to me, because in North Northeast Portland we have approximately 98% housing occupancy rates. And I was wondering the status of many of the refugees that have come here and what housing is like for them. Do you have any report on that whatsoever? Or do you find that being a troublesome area?
But 90% of the refugees are settled in the Tri-County area. We have about a 74% placement rate with this population within the time frames that are allowed, employment placement rate, within the time frames that are allowed. Whether whether we are experiencing a housing issue that is in addition to or different than the housing experience we're experiencing in general with populations that are living right about poverty level, I'm uncertain that whether it's unique to the refugee population.
How does, when we look at Oregon being number one in the country in terms of hunger, what percentage of those that are hungry are refugees? You would, and I know maybe at this point you might have to speculate, but.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I don't have, realistically, I'm not sure I can give you a number on that. I can give you the number of refugees that we have currently in the program. We have about, excuse me a minute, as well. We average about 132 new refugees per month, and the average looks like it's about we anticipate about 500 a month in receiving benefits, and about 1,300 a month receiving services. There's two components. There's the benefits, maintenance benefits that are provided in the first 8 months, and then refugees are entitled to and have access to employment services that last 60 months, and that's the 1,300. That's inclusive of the 500, but in addition to. So it's a small population in terms of the context of Oregon's population in total.
Is that information in one of our?
Yes, it is.
And two, is there, you said 132 new?
132 new a month is the average.
Is the average. Are they still coming from? Where are they coming from? Asia?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could draw your attention to page 446. And what you have, what should have there is a chart that shows the refugee arrivals to Oregon by country of origin. And I think that'll answer your question. Between the periods of 1975 through 98, the majority of refugees resettling in Oregon came from Vietnam, about 37%. Do we need a second to find our page 4-446? Between 75 and 98, 37%, the majority of refugees came from Vietnam. Currently, in 2002, if you notice by this chart, there's been a decided shift. That's dropped down to 6%, and now the vast majority, including 57%, are now coming from the Soviet Union.
Is that because of a change in national policy?
Yes. The determination of who is granted refugee status is determined by the State Department.
What's our match, federal match under the refugee program?
This is all federal funds.
It's 100%.
Yes. I believe there's a small amount of general fund in the staff and state staff, but it's a small amount.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So I think, Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I'd like to be able to do with TANF is essentially...
I do have a question before we get... What's Madam other? What constitutes other under the country of origin?
Well, Madam Chair, it would be all other countries, and I'd have to get your
so
breakdown.
It's just everything that...
Everything else.
Okay.
Obviously, refugees from Cuba, I think a Caribbean and Cuba primarily would be a group that would be identified there. But I don't believe that refugees from Cuba are presented separately in this chart. No, they're not.
I ask that because it's becoming a relatively high percentage. You know, you've got 57 Soviet.
Mm-hmm.
And Eastern Europe 19, and the other is the...
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to... we can get you a list of the breakdown.
Yeah, just curious.
Should be happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and for the temporary assistance to needy families, what I'd like to be able to do is, I think, just take one step back a little bit just to kind of wrap this discussion up. And I felt it was probably best to do that, to just try to present you with essentially what our strategy is, given the likelihood of reauthorization, the expectations under reauthorization, and the program designs that that presents for Oregon. We expect to be able to create a state-funded maintenance of effort track that would provide services to 25% of the population. That's a significant element of our strategy for two reasons. Number one, it is focused primarily on treatment for mental health, substance abuse, and medical issues. And that is a critical combination for participants in TANF. There is a portion of the population that need treatment as a primary service component, and that is not accountable activity under. We do not anticipate that to be accountable activity under reauthorization.
Yes. Are you on any specific page in the TANF report?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry. What you can do, if you're going in the TANF report, you could go to page 23. And in fact, that might actually kind of help us kind of guide through this discussion. Page 23, you see a chart there that just kind of breaks down the TANF population. So we have the maintenance of effort funded service treatment track for 25% of the population, and again the 25% is based primarily on frankly that's the amount that we could afford to serve under this treatment track. But the significance of it is financially is important to distinguish. If we had that same 25%. Engaged in countable services, countable activities, that would require us an additional $15 million to invest in countable services in order to enroll those individuals in those services. In addition, we probably anticipate another $7 million in child care that would be associated with their participation. So that's $22 million to enroll this 2,500 in other kinds of activities. So there are a number of reasons why the strategy is important to us, why it works well for us. I think the other component is the creation of a youth services track. And that youth services track allows us to focus on basic education and vocational education for parents age 19 or younger. And the significance of that is that it will allow us to establish a 20-hour-a-week participation expectation for these young parents, but also allow us to enroll them in vocational education. To not do that this way would require us to enroll them 40 hours a week in a work experience component. Those are the two critical elements. And ultimately, where that leaves us, though, by the time we construct this program, is to operate a fully resourced model under reauthorization would essentially cost us $150 million in a biennium. The governor's balanced budget has projected a cost of $101 million. And so that means that we are just going to have to do the best we can at operating this program with essentially two-thirds of the amount that it would cost to operate it if it was fully resourced. And that means we are going to have to start prioritizing those services. The first priorities would be the MOE component, the treatment component, the youth component.
They're telling you you did MOE and sitting there looking right at you.
Here we go.
Senator Carter, you didn't get that.
I'm telling you, I was just looking at another question. Thank you very much, Mr. Buckley.
Yes.
Rosie.
And furthermore, I don't know what MOE is. Maintenance of effort.
Maintenance of effort. I'm
got it. Sorry.
Representative Smith, I'm sorry.
Pardon me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so that leaves us with what it's going to cost us to construct countable activities under reauthorization, and that's primarily work experience and it's vocational education for the balance of the population, and that's what's left.
Question in the youth services component, of your 19 or younger, the young parents,
yes.
Is there an effort to get them to complete their general education diploma?
That is, Madam Chair, members of the committee, well done. that is the strategy. That is the service plan. But Madam Chair, it goes beyond that. It's not just completing the basic education. Then we want to enroll them in vocational education.
Yeah, I think that is so important. I'm just seeing a lot of young people where it's kind of not mandated, and I'm wondering how, what kind of maintenance of effort that you are applying to them mm-hmm. having to get a high school equivalency if not completing high school.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we can as a condition of eligibility, we can require participation in adult basic ed, but there's a good selling point as well, in that if they participate in education, both basic education and vocational education, their participation hours are 20 hours a week. If they don't, they're 40.
So,
and that's a pretty powerful argument.
So, you know, I have, we went to North Northeast Portland to Employment Division, the Committee on Transportation Economic Development. And we had a young woman with us that had not completed high school, but she was supposed to be in a program where she was completing high school, but because she had been doing some cosmetology.
Yes.
And she had not finished. What is the hook? I mean, you say that the hook is that you can require that, but how do you consistently make sure that the field workers are applying the concept? You know, even though you have it in policy, I don't see the application of it enough. And I know as I talk to young people, young mothers in North Northeast Portland.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, one of the components here, and we recognize that this is really a tough sell for this population, the value of doing what we've kind of outlined here. And one of the components of our strategy is to go to experts and try to develop a marketing strategy, if you will, that will kind of help us develop how we can effectively reach this population in order to convince them of the value of this. But once we've developed this model, then we plan to go out and train all SDAs in our service delivery area, our field staff, our case managers, in not only the program design but the expectations.
And this is you. When I was president of the Urban League, I was trying to work with the department on seeing if, because we had at the Urban League an afternoon program where we had hired a teacher and people come in, and we had a daytime program, but we just couldn't get, and maybe this is something you can check on with the agency, we just couldn't get the cooperation that we need to try to get more young people back into continuing education. Because it's going to, I think in terms of revenue, that we're going to have an even bleaker future if we don't get more of our young people into the revenue stream. And if they don't have a high school equivalency or high school education, it's just going to even be harder, which means we're going to spend money twice. We are spending the money for them to complete it, but then they're going to have to wait. They wait till they're 22 and go to the community college that we're paying twice for that. Somewhere along the line, the agency, if you guys could look at that as one of your goals for this next year, to make sure that the people in the local agencies would look at that as somewhat of a priority for getting them back in school, I think that's one of the best things we could do to assure young people coming off welfare and having the skills to get into the marketplace.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that's exactly why we've made this one of the pillars, if you will, of our strategy.
What are some of your hooks, if you will, that says that if you don't, this is what the consequences are?
Madam Chair, probably the biggest hook we have is in terms of the expectation of the program in terms of the number of hours a week of required activity. That at 20 hours a week, if you're in education activity, 20 hours a week. If you're in a work experience component or some other component, it's 40 hours a week. But ultimately, for teen parents, it's a condition of eligibility. In order to receive maintenance benefits, you have to willingly participate in educational activity if you haven't completed your basic education.
Is that understood initially with the participants?
Madam Chair, yes. I think that's explained.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think in conclusion, I think that's where we're faced with right now is essentially how we are going to operate a program at fully resourced levels that we project would cost about $150 million for 101. As all programs are going to be facing, how to do what they have to do with significantly less. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're looking at right now with TANF.
As you're probably aware that we weren't exempt from, Human Services was not exempt from the co-chair's direction that we find efficiencies and budgetary cuts. And so your priorities as you list them becomes very, very important and very, very, very critical as we go through the budgets. Although I have asked the other subcommittee chairs to be mindful of that we need them to really be efficient and due diligence because I'm looking for them in order to get them to assist us over here. But at the same time, I also have the same charge from the co-chairs to that these budgets we'll have to look at, and we're still at 10%, at 10% reductions. So I can't stress any more of how important it is to prioritize the absolutes that are necessary in order to keep your service. But at the same time, I have to share this with the members of this committee. As all of you know, that I worked for Governor T, and he called me the other day, kind of give me some encouragement after last week and before last and going through the 0103 budget. But he told me not to forget something, and then I told him I wouldn't, and that is that we have to make sure that we keep in place a structure that, this will pass at some point, but we have to have something to continue to build on. And I want the agencies to keep that in mind, too, that we're not going to sit here and decimate. But that the even though we have to have reductions, that we look to make sure that we're keeping our framework. So I just share that with you as you begin to look at your priorities to make certain that we're not doing destruction damage as we set the priorities. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that completes our discussion on TANF. I'm available for any questions that either you or members of the committee may have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordy.
Thank you very much. And I do have one question that goes to the chart that's on 422 program.
422?
Mm-hmm. Program growth or reduction. What is helpful for me is to keep the actual need that exists in the community in front of us as we are also talking about the need to make deductions. So looking at the chart, the graph, and the actual or projected caseload for July 03, how does that match up? How does that number match up with the actual need that exists in the community? Do you follow what I'm asking.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I do understand the question. It's very hard for us to project the number of families that may be eligible for these services but who choose not to access them for any number of reasons. What I can tell you, and maybe this goes the way to answering your question, is that with reauthorization, the requirements are going to be much stricter than they have been in the past. And it is very likely that we will have families that simply will choose not to participate in the program because they may feel that they just may not be able to actually participate, complete the participation. In other words, the expectations may be too much. But I have no way of projecting what kind of number that may be. And that would be the individual that when it's faced with 35 to 40 hours of requirements, and that individual, we say we cannot get that person into our treatment track because we can't serve everybody under that we may need to. The alternatives for that individual are not very good in terms of we'll work with them and try to diminish, but ultimately the program is going to expect a level of participation for that individual that I'm not sure it's realistic that individual can do. And I'm not sure what we're left with. And I have no way of projecting what kind of number that really represents.
Thank you.
But I do appreciate your pointing that out, and we recognize that there is a segment of this population that this is going to be very hard on.
Exactly. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
Since Senator Gordley has already pointed to a chart that I've been familiar with ever since I joined the Welfare Review Commission on 422, and since she's raised the issue of the need that is out there as opposed to what's graphed, would it be fair to say that you could almost put another line? You notice how it starts at 40,000 and drops to 15, and now it's come back up a little. Wouldn't it be almost fair to put another line that just kind of points out these people didn't disappear. They're just now under a new category called, you know, the working poor, and you know, the 40,000 are still there. They just don't really get any assistance from the state or the federal government. They're working poor families.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, part of this population is that population that we were talking about a week ago around employment-related daycare, that group that kind of bounced back and forth. Part of this population is employment-related daycare. Part of this population is working and has income somewhere around 100% of poverty level, maybe 150, somewhere in that band. And that is a population that need services, but for whom systems are not really set up or structured or funded to provide a consistent set of services for the working poor. The Temporary Assistance Needy Family Program has been attempting in the last 5 years to try to develop service components to start targeting the working poor for the next set of services in terms of wage progression services, how you take working with an individual that is 125% of poverty level, how do you get them up to the next level so that they can be completely free of the system? That's one of the set of services that we're very likely going to have to drop out. That's about $4 million in post-placement services, which is not likely to be able to afford that. But that is not to say that population doesn't exist. They're out there. I think the trick is being able to define them as a specific subset of the total population. And the best we can probably do that is by percentage of poverty level income.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, any other questions? All right. I think that completes the temporary.
Thank you. And Rosie, thanks you too.
Yes.
Very, very good. We need to keep him employed, Madam Chair, so we can.
Pardon?
Need to keep him employed so he can keep feeding.
If there's any, you know, we can talk about emergency assistance now. If there's any questions, or you want to share with us what's occurring in emergency assistance.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if there are any questions around emergency assistance, As you know, for emergency assistance is divided up into two basic groups. There's the regular emergency assistance, of which we suspended in January due to budget reductions, and the emergency assistance for domestic violence, which is continued on. Now, both programs are included in the governor's balanced budget, and there are some discussion going on around how we might, strategies for how we might approach the continuation of emergency assistance, for the regular emergency assistance, whether we might have had some discussions with the housing, community services and housing around some strategies about how we might work together, different ways of approaching emergency assistance.
And I understand that there's a possibility we've got the April rebalance, and so we'll probably get new budget figures in April. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm Ramona Foley, and our next panelist is Tony Peterson, and we're beginning now to start the child welfare portion of the presentation.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tony Peterson, Interim Deputy Assistant Administrator for Children, Adults, and Families.
Would you restate that?
Oh.
That's okay.
And my presentation is on Child Protective Services, and it's on page 461 in the book. One of the most critical goals of the department is to ensure the safety of Oregon's abused and neglected children. And from the end of last biennium until this point in time, our experience continues to mirror the national trends. We have seen a decrease in founded child abuse and neglect victims. We've seen a stabilization of the number of children in substitute care, and we've seen an increase in finalized adoptions. Over the past 2 years, we have engaged in a number of policy and practice changes that have resulted in the improved identification of children with safety issues. We have been offering earlier intervention in the lives of those children and in their families. And we have been seeking to offer more effective help to those families. Some of those things that we have put together are early team decision meetings, where we convene a family meeting much earlier after we intervene with a family. We have also added a due process for those who are perpetrators in founded abuse cases to allow them to have a review of that finding. Both of these improvements and the others that we've implemented have, we believe, led to better outcomes and greater accountability for children and their families.
Senator Carter.
I'm wondering if, Ramona, you guys could take the opportunity to speak very frankly in terms of the safety net system and how we do not replicate what happened in Oregon City. Talk to me about the procedure you have for working with the police and who's ultimately responsible for things in a most fastidious manner, and how did we create a level of for lack of another word, excellence, if you will, and making sure that we respond in a way faster than what we responded in the last situation, so that nobody can point systems. There's a clearly defined relationship between our responsibility as a parent, as a state, as a parent in that way, and so that our kids can, we know that there's a system in place that allows us to work more better, more efficiently. That's what I was looking for on the part of our children.
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, we anticipated those very questions, and so as Tony proceeds, she's going to be talking about some new practice that we're bringing into place. You'll hear discussions about 24-hour contact, which really emphasizes making contact the first time we get a report on a child, not after there are multiple reports, and other relationship issues, as you point out, with law enforcement, how we've tried to expedite some of the contact with law enforcement, but working with law enforcement so as not to overwhelm their system with the number of reports that come in each year.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I can speak to the two studies that we conducted as a result of the case in Clackamas County. We did, as a department, an internal review of what occurred there, and what we did find was that we had employees who did not follow the policy that we had in place, and in review of that policy, we found that it needed to be strengthened. And we immediately changed that practice through memo across the state on September 13th of last year. We filed an emergency rule regarding a change in the cross-reporting requirements. And cross-reporting is a part of the statute that requires both child welfare, Department of Human Services, and law enforcement to cross-report child abuse and neglect. And
Carter, excuse me. Should that, so does cross-reporting mean, tell me what cross-reporting means.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, cross-reporting means that if law enforcement has the first contact with a family, they're required to cross-report concerns of abuse and neglect to Department of Human Services. If DHS, Department of Human Services,
Rosie likes you too,
has the first report, we are required by statute to inform the local law enforcement agency.
Now, does local local law enforcement include sheriff and police?
They, Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that would be Oregon State Police, County Sheriff, and City Police, depending on where the incident took place. And in we determine which location to send that report based on the local multidisciplinary team protocols. And those multidisciplinary teams are in every county chaired by the local district attorney. And so in County A, it may be that the request is that report would go to the most local of law enforcement agencies, and that could be the city police department. Many counties have several small city police departments. In County B, it could be that they all go to the sheriff's office. And in certain situations, we work with the Oregon State Police.
Follow up. How can we be assured that Department of Human Services has not dropped the ball?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that's a very fair question. In addition to implementing our emergency rule in October, we spent a period of time seeking input from our law enforcement partners and have revised that rule, and it is out now for state review with an implementation date of March 18th, 2003. We have provided training throughout the state on what the expectations are. We have increased the requirements for supervisory review of their line staff's work. We are requiring closer monitoring. However, all of those things are as good as the supervision and the expectation that we have. Our expectations are very high, and we are continuing to emphasize those.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ramona, I felt kind of stupid last year because I called the agency in responding to Lars Larson on radio, and the information was not clearly given to me enough. Even though I did talk to Ms. Peterson, but somewhere along the line, Madam Chair, I think that agencies have to realize that as legislators, we have as much of a responsibility as the governor does in answering to the public. And I want to see something so clearly defined that if I should have to call in again with something of this nature, I don't want to get crosswise with the governor, but I want to be responsible as a legislator. As if all of us have to be responsible for responding to the media in terms of these kind of emergencies, so that if the policies are clearly defined enough, you don't have to be concerned whether we, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't put you guys in basket, because you know how I respect human services and feel myself a part of what happens and what you go through with, because I know you're an agency that damned if you do and damned if you don't. And so I respect that very much. But I want to be able, when I go on the public airways, to make sure that I'm communicating very clear, very precise policies that we have as a state, so that it won't be seen as if I'm trying to, you know, cover up for the agencies, but nobody's covering up. It's human error that sometimes gets in the way, and I want to be able to respond in a very positive but clearly defined way in terms of policies.
I think it's Senator Carter brought up an interesting issue, because often you're going to get calls when something happens within your agency from legislators. And I don't think legislators want to be put off with the confidentiality, and that's where you go, with the confidentiality statement. And clearly, I think information can be given without violating the confidentiality piece. And I think that's what Senator Carter is referring to, because there's nothing worse than for us to be called by the media and asked for our opinion or what do we think, and then we're not able to clearly talk about the process or talk about it in a way to where we don't end up looking stupid. And I think you can give the information without divulging some of the confidentiality pieces. And I know that the agency, having been there, is very cautious often, particularly when you think that something may end up further down the road with litigations and what have you, and we're bound by our confidentiality. So I think as you work through talking rules and regs, and you press upon the people, particularly out in the field, because that's where they tend to the most of not wanting to give out information. And maybe the solution to that is that, for us, that it's really taking it at a higher level, at Ramona's level, or somewhere higher in the system, to be able to get the response. So.
And maybe Sarah, because she, Ms. Peterson, did a good job in talking to me, but there's so much she couldn't say, you know. Mm-hmm. And if policies are in place, you don't have to worry about whether she is not giving correct information, because that was a hard one for you to have to give me direction for me to go on the airways about. But at the same time, I think if the policies are clearly defined and in place, we can say this and this and this is what happened or what was supposed to happen.
Given that you have so many entities that are involved in responding, and it makes it somewhat very complicated, because you don't know whether it happened at the sheriff's level or at the city's level or all these levels. And I'm just pleased to hear that you're working with all those entities to make sure that they respond. But human error is also human error. And even with sometimes with policy in place, doesn't mean that the police department, whether it's the sheriff or the state police or even, the city police, when they get busy and bogged down, may not act as rapidly as we would like to have them respond. And I just think that somehow it should be where, when we're talking about the cross-reporting, mm-hmm. that there's also some ranking or priorities within that reporting. So that there's some red alerts. We talked about the amber alerts. Maybe we need some red alerts within this system as well. And with that, Senate Representative Tootie Smith and then Greg Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said you had the interagency agreement between yourself and the police departments. As we know, the public safety budgets have been cut. Are they going to be able to implement that in this era of budget cutting on their end? I'm kind of concerned, you know, about that. With all good intentions and everything, they just may not be able to find the time or resources to do it. I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, This has been in statute for a number of years, the cross-reporting requirement. What we did in our rule was further clarify for our employees what they're required to do. However, yes, local law enforcement are facing budget cuts, and this is a concern for all of us.
Okay. Great. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I want to go back to the tragedy that occurred in Oregon City, and I guess I still have a level of confusion in that today we've heard that it was lack of following through on public policy, and yet what was reported in the media was very different. Can you share with me, one, what is your department's policy on dealing with the media when these type of tragedies occur? And two, how did we get from what was reported in the media that perhaps the responsibility lied with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office to where we are today, to where we're hearing that it's human error that costs the life of two girls? So I know there's two questions there, but if you could share with me a little bit.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, when we have a high-profile case like this, we seek to be as open with the media as we can. There are also factors that we need to take into consideration. If there is a criminal investigation underway, we don't want to do anything that would jeopardize that investigation. We also are required, both by federal and state statute, to follow confidentiality rules, and we need to be very careful and respectful of that. So we walk kind of a fine line with media in terms of being able to provide information for them without jeopardizing either an individual's right to privacy or a criminal investigation that may be underway. And
question. So was the media inaccurately reporting that the Department of Human Services had made contact with the Sheriff's Department in relation to the need for them to go out and check with these?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we were able to review our piece, the Department of Human Services piece, and our responsibilities in this particular case. We did not have the authority to review what the Sheriff's Office did or what the Oregon City Police Office did or the District Attorney did. We only were able to review our Clackamas Branch Office piece of this equation. And our review of our employees' work there found that our employees did not follow the policy that we had in place. And secondly, we found that our rule and policy needed to be strengthened, and we took action to do that. There are still many things that are not public because the criminal investigation continues.
I think, you know, it's kind of interesting because the agency has wrestled with this issue for a long time. It's not something, and just the case was a tragic one, but the communication and how do you make sure that you're not violating the privacy issue? How do you make sure that you're also are giving, you're not violating the criminal piece? And it's like sometimes I think walking on a tightrope because the public wants to know, and yet there are elements inside that the agency really cannot talk about or discuss. And I'm, you know, very mindful of that. I happened to be there when we passed the first protective service statutes, and it's one that has been wrestled with and trying to refine over 30-some years of dealing in protective services. There are components that, quite honestly, based on federal and state statutes, that the agency is bound under the confidentiality statute to protect those privacies. And at the same time, they have no authority over the law enforcement agency. In they also have no authority over individuals who send them a complaint, and they must also keep their name under statute confidential. So there's a lot of confidentiality that's enshrouded when we talk about protective services and reporting. Just had to put that out there because often I think people think that somehow the agency itself is hiding, and when in fact it's not, it's doing what it's doing based on the statutes or the law that's there, whether it's federal or state, in the protection of children.
Thank you, Chairwoman Smith.
Representative Smith.
I guess the reason I was asking my question is the fact of the matter is tragically two girls lost their life, and I guess I need assurance because when that occurred, I felt like every member of this legislative body was responsible for a portion of that. And I guess I want assurance more than just we're looking at the policy to know that this isn't going to happen again and that the life of two girls isn't going to be lost. Because we didn't have the correct procedures in place. And I want to know what safeguards are being put in place to ensure that our state employees, who for the most part are diligent, hardworking, and very, very concerned and caring, that this isn't going to happen again.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, Department of Human Services is one of several partners that is in Oregon to protect the safety and well-being of children.
Mm-hmm.
And the first protector in that front is the child's family. And if the child's family isn't able to protect, then the state and the county intervene. And we each have a different role in that protection. We're law enforcement, the district attorney, the courts all have a role. And our focus with the Department of Human Services employees is to provide training, to provide close supervision, and to make sure each employee has a clear understanding of what the rules and policies are in their job and to protect children. And that is our goal and our objective.
Yeah, I'm going to move on because we can get really bogged in this, and truly it was a tragedy, but truly also is, if I look at these numbers of the amount of referrals to this agency that they have to begin to work with, I don't think our budget that we've allocated for them provides them with the revenue to actually deal with the number of cases that they deal with. I think we've got a part to play in this too. We've got a part to play to make sure that we're not giving them these massive caseloads that they can't handle. I've got to put that out there because it's one thing to set and talk about the agency. It's another thing to say whether we have given them the tools to adequately address the issue of abuse and neglect in this state. I think when I came back in this building, one of my highest priorities was to take Oregon out of that range where we were, what we couldn't be pleased with the amount of abuse and neglect that we have occurring in Oregon. And it's related to dysfunctional families. You know, we can go over these subjects all over, but I don't want to beat up on the agency. I want to say, you know, you're putting it in place. It was a terrible, terrible tragedy, but I also understand that your caseloads are high. I understand that in order for the caseworkers to do their job, that they also need the tools for this body to give them the tools to work with.
Madam Chair, if I may, a couple of things. Jean Thorne testified a few weeks ago, and one of the things she talked about when she testified was making sure we have reconnected policy and the field. And I think that's a critical element here, because you're right, you shouldn't have to shop around to find who knows the correct policy. The policy is the policy. There may be some modification, depending on what part of the state you're in terms of how the multidisciplinary team accepts the report, for example. But another thing we're doing is we are also improving some of the automation with the system so we can tell, a manager can tell how soon a contact is made, how soon is the face-to-face contact made. Our system hasn't been able to do that as well as it should. And when we have the testimony from Community Human Services at the end of this week or beginning of next week, you will also hear the efforts we're making to reestablish a supervisor-to-worker ratio. that is focused enough that the supervisor actually knows whether or not the worker is responding within the required time frame. Oregon has an unusual part of its law with the reciprocity of reporting, where law enforcement reports everything to DHS, Department of Human Services, here's my five, and it goes and it's back and forth. In some states, in many states, we testified before the Judiciary Committee, in many states, if there is an element of criminal activity or if it is what we call third-party abuse, the law will specify that report does not go to the Department of Human Services but goes first to law enforcement. Then, if a report comes into law enforcement where there's criminal activity but it looks like children are at risk, they then have the responsibility to report that to the Department of Human Services. Oregon, over the years, has chosen to have the reciprocity on every case. That does present some issues regarding the amount of information that must be transferred back and forth within a very timely basis between law enforcement and human services. It's something that Oregon may want to look at, may want to examine. There seems to be a need to make sure that no report gets missed, and I think that's part of the inspiration by having every report go back and forth between the two. But making sure those are done timely is a critical need of ours and one that we are trying to make sure that the automated system will also account for that to the manager.
I'm going to send a card that I'm going to have.
Just a statement to you. I think that is so important. We've enjoyed in this state being small enough to be on top of our children. I just don't want – this is not about the agency to me. This is about Oregon's decision to fund or not fund the safety of its children.
That's right.
And so we are in this together. It might seem that we're asking critical questions, but it's not just to say to the agency, you're not being affected. How can you have 859,208 children 0 to 18 in Oregon and they have to be responsible here? But you also see it imposes upon us as legislators the responsibility of saying to the public or saying to the large Larsons, listen, we just don't have the money in the state to be as accountable as we need to be.
That's right.
I mean, that's where we come in as a servant who serve the people and making sure good information is out there. And I think that is very crucial because I have to ask, of a population of about 900,000 kids, what's the case management ratio here? And I don't think you can give us guarantees that this situation will not replicate itself at some time, no matter how many policies we put in place. Ramona, all we can do is continue to try to be on the offensive by making sure they're in place, but we can't guarantee this won't happen again. You know.
I know you want to bring closure, Chair.
I do want to bring closure because I'm going to have to leave and I'm going to pass my gavel on.
I just want to echo, though, just really quick, if that's okay, Chair, what the good senator from Portland was saying. And I think that's where my comments were going with this. It's with no intention of beating up the department. I just want to hear and know that procedures are in place to protect these children, and if that requires more money, then I want to hear that, and I want to know what we as a committee are facing, because I think it's our responsibility as much as yours to know what we are facing and from my perspective, to brush it over isn't appropriate, and that's why I raise these points.
I'm going to move on, but I just have to make a final comment. I would hope that at some point in this state that we get to the place where we're talking about preventing abuse from happening. I would hope at some point that we will look at the Healthy Starts and the relief nurseries and look at teen parenting and some of those tools that are out there so that we're on the prevention end so that Ramona and others will not be talking to us about the number of children who are abused and neglected. That, you know, children become our focus, to where we really truly are going to raise and bring in healthy children in this state. I need to go now, and I'm going to pass the gavel because I've got to go have a little minor some stitches removed. Mm. You didn't give them to me, by the way, and put more money in Rosie.
Ms. Peterson. Child Protective Services is measured by the Federal Child Welfare Performance Indicator for recurrence of child maltreatment. And that is the same outcome that we have for the Department of Human Services, and it's also the Oregon benchmark. And what that means is a measurement of reabuse of children. So that measurement, and at the top of page 62, the national standard is 6.1% fewer children had another substantiated report within 6 months of a prior substantiated report. Wow. So the measurement is reabuse. And you can see Oregon's data here at the top of page 62. That data has declined. Our goal with the federal government is to continue that decline to meet the goal of 6.1%. From 1999 to 2001, we have had an increase in reports of suspected abuse and neglect, and we've had a decrease in the number of victims. And that has been also mirroring a national trend. The reasons behind that are the increased public awareness of child abuse and neglect. And because of that, we have more people who are aware of it and who are reporting their concerns. Oregon has done a very good job in training mandatory reporters, and they take that responsibility very seriously. Factors that have contributed to a decrease in founded abuse have involved a variety of things. The services in our state, as Chair Winter said before she left, regarding the prevention of abuse, have had impact. We have been able to intervene in the lives of families and children before abuse has occurred. And I think that we have seen that trend in Oregon. We also have implemented some services through system of care that have allowed us to provide enhanced services to families to help them address the concerns that led to abuse and neglect and to prevent further abuse and neglect. The numbers at the bottom break down the last 2 years. In 2001, we received slightly over 36,000 reports, and that was an increase of 21% over 2000. And 2.1%. I'm sorry, 2.1% over 2000. There were 8,232 child abuse and neglect victims in 2001, and that was a 19.2% decrease from the previous year. And as you look to the next,
excuse me, Tony, how many kids were murdered in the state in 2000 between 2001 and 2002?
Madam Chair, I don't have that data with me, but we do have it in our annual report, and I can provide it to you.
I think that would be an interesting piece of information, so that when we see that we are underfunding this agency, what is at stake?
Yes.
Thank you.
If you move over to the next page, page 63, you can see the distribution of the incidents of abuse and neglect. And that graph shows mental injury, physical abuse, neglect, and sexual abuse, and then those same categories also under threat of harm. And Oregon has a statute that allows us to then count those kinds of abuse for children who are at risk of that abuse. And for example, threat of harm of sexual abuse. You may have a young mother whose boyfriend, who is a convicted sex offender, moves in with her family. Now,
there hasn't been an abuse incident that's occurred, but certainly there is a threat of harm in that situation. And so we count both of those categories. And when you move on to the next page, you can see the breakout by year and the relationship between threat of harm and incidents of actual abuse and neglect. And during the mid to the late 90s, we had a significant growth in threat of harm. And as we looked at that growth, we agreed that several of the contributors to that were beyond what the legislature intended for threat of harm. And so we have created a tightened and stronger definition of threat of harm, and we have also required that staff have to have a face-to-face contact before founding a case of abuse or neglect. In the past, we sometimes founded abuse based on a police report rather than sending our staff out to have face-to-face contact. We have also, during that time period, implemented a due process notification to those who are perpetrators of abuse and neglect. So we've had a variety of factors influence our data. But our data for 2001, again, shows the 36,303 reports of suspected abuse and neglect, and then a 8,232 founded reports. And if you go on to the next page, 65, you can see that ratio compared to all of the children in the state of Oregon, the total population. And then out of our referrals, how many completed assessments, how many are closed at screening, and how many are founded referrals. And out of the founded referrals, how many victims, and then how many of those victims are able to stay at home with services and the development of a safety plan. And then of those children, how many need to be taken into protective custody and placed in foster care? 60% of the victims are able to stay at home with intensive services.
Is the person that's threatening removed from here, or what happens?
In most of those situations, either the perpetrator is removed, or we're able to work with the family and build a safety plan for that, for the child or for the children. And it depends on the situation. In cases of minor abuse, we're much more likely and highly successful in working with those parents to maintain the children at home through changed behaviors in that family, parent training, etc. And on the next page, 66, we go into the details of that service plan process that we put together when working with a family when we have a substantiated report of abuse. The service plan always addresses the findings of the assessment. We include all the family members when possible in that planning process. And we seek to use a family decision model to build that plan. We must, by federal statute and state statute, make reasonable efforts to maintain a child safely at home. And if we can't do that and a child goes into substitute care, we have to make reasonable efforts to safely return that child home.
And if I might insert there, we had a conversation recently with Judge Pratt from over in Ontario. And he wanted to express concern because as courts are seeing these families, any case has to come to court if the child has been removed. And because of the federal and state requirement to do reasonable efforts, there's kind of a growing concern about overall impact of what's happening with the budget here in Salem and how that will play itself out in rural parts of the state. He says he has a number of methamphetamine moms who have come into the purview of the court, their children coming into care. And he just wanted to be sure that we recognize that the problems with drugs and how those are impacting parents are not just a phenomena of the I-5 corridor. He wanted to make sure that we know that in the rural parts of this state, and we are working with the judges in this regard, there's no advantage for the judge other than following the law to say we have not made reasonable efforts. But if the judge has to declare we haven't made reasonable efforts, that means we can't get federal funding for that particular case. So the judges are very concerned about this, and I wanted to be sure and insert that at some point during the testimony.
Thank you, Chair Carter. How do you deal with cultural sensitivities as it relates to different parts of the state? In my previous district, I represented John Day, very, very conservative, would have a very, very different standard than I would surmise folks on this side of the state would have. How do you deal with those issues?
Madam Chair, Senator Smith, we have a variety of cultural differences across our state. Race, culture, urban, rural, from community to community in both urban counties and rural counties. And we seek to address those in a variety of ways. Racial and cultural issues, we seek to employ staff who are representative of the population of Oregon. We have bicultural, bilingual staff. And when we get into situations where we have different community standards, we seek to work very closely with our community partners to make sure that those community standards are reflected in how we work together as a team. For example, the multidisciplinary team chaired by the district attorney. We also have to balance that with what the law says and how we respond to the statutes. And the final arbiter for that is the court. We present to the court and all cases where children are removed from their homes have a court hearing within 24 hours. And those factors play out there. We seek to be responsive, and we seek to use the check and balance system that is in place in our communities. Thank you. In addition, we have some federal requirements when children are removed from their own homes. We are required to develop what's called a concurrent plan, and that is we work with the family on two sets of issues. One is every effort to safely return that child home. And secondly, if that child can't go back home to their parents, what is the alternative plan? And that might be with relatives, other members of extended family, or that could be adoption for a child. As I said before, work closely with the courts and with the Citizen Review Board when children are removed from care. So the actual services that we offer for families, on page 67, is a listing of the majority of those services that we have available in child protective services cases. Family support teams and alcohol and drug service facilitators focus specifically on getting families into alcohol and drug treatment. And that is a significant factor in our child abuse cases. The documented incidence of alcohol and drug use is documented over 60%. We think it's up to 85%, maybe even higher. It is a significant factor in the lives of young families and contributes to abuse and neglect.
Madam Chair.
Senator Worley.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering about the availability of alcohol and drug services in this environment of reductions. And what will that look like in our communities as we're talking about, you know, the wraparound services for families who are in dire straits and who need an alcohol and drug referral? Where are they going to go?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we share those concerns. Those who are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan Plus with children in home are eligible for outpatient alcohol and drug treatment services. Those parents whose children are not at home and who may still be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan would only be eligible for residential treatment services. We're working now closely with the alcohol and drug treatment portion of the department, with local providers, with our region office in Seattle, to determine any kind of flexibility that we might have to maintain those services. I think it's too soon to tell right now what we may have available for those families, but it is a critical service.
It just seems, Madam Chair, that as soon as we know what that picture looks like, it would be helpful to have that information so that if we know that yesterday we had, and this is an example, 80% service available on demand, and it's going to be, and we know it's going to be something a whole lot less than that tomorrow, then we need to know what does that whole lot less look like, and also where is it located in our communities. And I'm assuming that someone is assembling that information as we speak.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, there are staff who are.
So, Senator, in essence, you're talking about what is the backup plan for the department in terms of this environment that we live today?
That would be part of the question, mm-hmm. What is the backup plan? But also the realization that there will be no services for a lot of people who need them. They just won't exist.
Correct.
Madam Chair, there will be a discussion of the alcohol and other drug addiction services as part of the health services budget, probably at least several weeks out at this point. But that budget will come before this subcommittee.
Thank you. Ms. Peterson?
Yes. The remaining services here, for the most part, on this page, on page 67, are services that are contracted out to local providers, and they are delivered at the community level across the state. And they're a wide range of services, treatment services both for children and for parents, family sex abuse treatment, parent training, intensive family services, intensive home-based services. And those are designed to provide services both in the family home or at community-based sites to help those families overcome the issues that cause the abuse and neglect and allow us then to safely reunite those children with their parents.
Well, Madam Chair, I would have the same concern about all of the services listed on the page. This is a description of what currently exists on March 10th, 2003, that the world is going to look very different in a few months. And so we really need to have an accurate picture of what does that contract community look like out there in our various counties around the state, rather than giving an impression that there are these services that families are going to be, that we're going to be contracting with to help all these families, because that isn't what's going to be happening at all.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have, you make a very good point. We have taken significant cuts in each of these program areas during the past year, and Measure 28 took additional cuts in these programs. For example, supportive remedial daycare has been cut by 50% of what it was. Those cuts will continue into the 2003-2005 biennium.
I'm sorry, excuse me for a minute.
I'm finished. Thank you.
As Senator Gordley started this questioning on this page, I underlined the word contracted or contracts everywhere it appeared on the page. And it occurs to me that when contracts go away, we lose capacity. So even if we want to put the state back together in a couple years, we may not have the capacity to do so. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I have a real concern about that. And because of that, I have a question that I know is impossible to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And that is, how do you estimate the cost of this kind of dismantling of a structure that will be very difficult to put back together, both in terms of human lives, A, but B, in terms of the actual cost to society for the alternatives? For example, I was talking to the sheriff in Multnomah County, and this is a different subject this morning, but he was talking about the way his prison system in Multnomah County is going to be turned into essentially wards for keeping mentally ill. You know, we don't treat them in one place, we end up treating them in another place, or not treating them in another place, we just warehouse them in a county jail. There's a cost to that. So is it of less cost to actually treat them in the community, or is it of less cost to just let the system fall apart, put them in jail? If we're trying to make Hobson's choice here, we need to see the whole picture. I mean, yeah, we can go through here and we can cut all these various contracts and save all these nickels, dimes, and dollars here, but that doesn't necessarily make the cost go away. It'll just make it show up somewhere else in society. And so if you're going to help us to make these choices, we need to see this cost as versus the cost of not providing the service. And I know that's darn near impossible, but to be fair to the state of Oregon, we'd have to try to do it somehow.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, you're correct. I'm not able to answer that question. I will tell you some of the things we're trying to do to maintain some sort of infrastructure. For many of these contracts, we went out to the contractors knowing what situation we were in and having a good idea of what was ahead for us, and worked with them to look at, were there ways to combine some contracts? Were there ways to create different ways of doing business? Because particularly in some of our rural areas, the volume is so much smaller, the size of the contract reaches a point where an infrastructure cannot be maintained. And contractors have chosen to combine with each other to cover larger geographic areas. We have created some master contracts to be more flexible in order to do both pieces, provide the service, but also provide support to maintain an infrastructure. There is a point of diminishing returns there, however.
Sheila, when we do rebounds and you have a better picture of what's actually going to be done.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, when there will be basically two updates, if you will come before the subcommittee. One will be a rebalancing of the department's 2001-2003 budget, which will reflect not only the House Bill 5100 reductions, but some the add-backs that were included in Senate Bill 5548 and other adjustments that may be necessary, either upward or downward, based on various caseloads in the department and various cost changes. So we'll have an opportunity to look at the 2001-03 budget again, and it will have reductions in it to reflect what's happened so far. It may have additional reductions. We don't know that at this point. And then there will be, before or when we get to work session, the department and the governor's office will have done what has in the past been called a reshoot of the proposed governor's budget. Again, updating for all the things that happened in 2001-03 budget period, and then projecting that forward for 2003 05. So there will be several different opportunities at which we'll get new updated numbers to see what the land currently looks like now, because, you know, you're correct, what's in the governor's budget at this point is not representative of what is actually happening even in 0103.
The reason I ask this question, colleagues, so that if anybody needs to talk with Ramona and talk with some of about the management staff in terms of some input about what is going to have to be chopped away, that they might think of that. And one thing I know about them is they are always available to talk to us about these issues, and we'll have some input into them. Thank you. That's pretty good.
I would like to shift gears and talk now about some plans that changes that we have in the works to improve practice for the future. And
any place in this book?
Pardon?
Is it any place?
It would be on page 69.
69, got you.
Okay. And it's called the 24-hour response and guided assessment process. We, for a couple of years, have been looking at our child protective services process and how quickly we are able to respond to reports of abuse and neglect, not only through a face-to-face contact, but also how quickly we're able to conclude our assessments. And we weren't entirely happy with how quickly we were doing this work. And so we have been in the process of developing a much shortened time frame. Excuse me. It'll be 2 years in June. The Federal Child and Family Services Review came to Oregon and reviewed our child welfare practice. And one of their findings was that, yes, Oregon, you are taking too long to complete your assessments. And we want you to develop a plan to shorten that time period. And so we have entered into a program improvement plan with the federal government. And this is essentially what the primary elements of that are. It's called the guided assessment process, and it has a couple of different parts. One is a significant paradigm shift in shortening the time for initial contact. It is a shift from assessment of ongoing risk in a family to the assessment of current safety concerns for the child. The model changes an extended screening process, which we use right now, which can last for as long as 5 days, to a much shortened screening time frame, and that would be 24 hours or less for screening. And then right now, our policy allows up to several days for that first face-to-face contact with the child, and the new policy and requirement will be face-to-face contact within 24 hours. And these policies and practice will begin a progressive assessment of child safety throughout the life of the case, not only at the front door, but at critical junctures throughout the life of the case. And those critical junctures would be at the point where we're making a decision to return a child home. We have to assess and make sure everything is safe so we don't have a repeat of the abuse incident. When we're getting ready to close a case, it's very important to make sure that all of the safety threats have been addressed.
Tony?
Yes.
I think the one thing that as you are making these changes, that people should know that on this leadership watch, that you're changing from where the field dynamics are different to where the policies, back to Ramona, where the policies are more clarified down the line than what it was before. And so, colleagues, we should take heart in the fact that some of the things that happened prior to, well, 2 years ago was not with this administration, but these changes are coming as a result of this administration.
We also had a review. We commissioned a review of our child protective services intake process. And from an organization here in Portland called Public Knowledge. And this was as a result of the Clackamas County case as well. We wanted an in-depth review across the state of our practice. And their findings also supported the changes that we're going to be making. They had a significant number of recommendations as well regarding our computer system and how it is used to provide performance reports to our supervisors and our staff, and also addressed how we can have electronic contact through the law enforcement database and other databases with community partners. But the findings essentially were that Child Protective Services is an effective in Oregon is an effective practice, and it requires a careful balance between prescriptive policy and sound professional judgment. The study also found that DHS has the policies, the systems, and the procedures in place to measure performance. It found that our branches were making diligent efforts to comply with policy, but that there were these opportunities to improve. And the primary thing they focused on, in addition to the computer system, was the implementation of the guided assessment process. So we will be emphasizing the reduced length of time to complete the screening activities, the identification of the immediate safety threats, the use of an automated guided assessment process, and then all of these things will contribute to greater consistency statewide in our screening decisions.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Again, just seeking some clarity here, Ms. Peterson. It sounds like the findings in the report that you referenced focus on, as you said, policies, systems, procedures, and the state's ability, the department's ability to implement. But what I didn't hear, and this goes to the question or the concern that Representative Greg Smith raised earlier, was more clarity around what is our capacity really to deliver on this new process that we must implement. Capacity has a cost, resources, dollars. And is the capacity, were the resources, adequate resources, built into the governor's budget? And if they were or were not, and we're now in this reduced budget mode, how can we ensure that the resources are going to be there to deliver on the capacity that's required to get to the implementation that's required for these new policies, systems, and procedures, et cetera? A lot of words. You don't understand what I'm asking.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the key piece in Oregon to delivering child protective services is our line staff and our line supervisors. Those are state employees, and in the governor's balanced budget, we aren't seeing cuts predicted or projected in line staff for child protective services or for line managers, line supervisors. So that, given that, and if that remains unchanged, we believe that we do have the capacity to make this systems change. The training is scheduled to start April 14th. And we will do statewide training during the balance of the month of April, all of the month of May. Our goal will be to have this fully implemented by June 1st. And that will be for our current employees. For our new employees, when we have vacancies and we fill positions, This will be part of our new employee curriculum. And, excuse me, the changes in the computer system are currently being programmed. We will train our staff to that computer system, and the governor's balanced budget maintains that computer system.
Madam Chair, did I understand correctly that we have dismantled our training department? And if so, how did you plan on implementing your training?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, we have not disbanded or dismantled our training program for Child Protective Services or for child welfare. That's a program-specific training program that is in place. The department is dismantling something called continuous system improvement, which offered department-wide training of a more general nature, and that is in the process of being dismantled.
And if I may, Chair Carter and Senator Morse, in fact, what we are doing and what Jean Thorne will testify to when she does department-wide services is we're trying to maintain those pieces of overall training, such as management training, and those are being moved to administrative services. But the function called continuous system improvement, we've just been through a process to find where do those various pieces that we need to keep belong in the department without having a whole separate division called continuous system improvement.
I believe there are 21 employees in the general training group. Is that correct?
Continuous system improvement had about 25 or 26, I think, total. So that would include the training group.
And that group has been discontinued?
The group is being, some of those employees are going to administrative services and will continue with training, but it's the overall agency training, such as management training. We've gone through a list as recently as this morning looking at what the training priorities are that are general in nature. They can include things like orientation. We've discontinued orientation for new employees until July 1. But that's one that we anticipate we would build back in. Training for how we do reception at the front door in all of our local offices. So there are a number of examples of the kind of training we're talking about, but that is separate and apart from all the program training. The program training still resided within the clusters. It was never actually moved to continuous system improvement.
Thank you.
That concludes my presentation, unless you have other questions.
Any questions?
We had hoped to get into system of care discussion today. We have about 15 minutes left.
Ramona, what is your pleasure? I mean, do you want to get started on it, or would you rather begin anew tomorrow? What is your pleasure?
I would yield to your pleasure, Madam Chair. It's short in length if you look in the book, and it's possible we could get through the discussion.
That's right.
This is one that has been impacted by budget.
Okay. That's right.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Beth Englander-Vaughan, and I'm currently the Child Protective Services Manager with Children, Adults, and Families, new in that role. I'm here to present to you on the System of Care program, which I've continued to manage at least through the present time. I was a manager for the program for the last 2 years. This afternoon, I'd like to talk about the implementation of the agreement, the outcomes that we have and that we know about at this point in time, the core elements of the System of Care agreement, the legal settlement agreement that carry forward without the resources, and then I'd also like to talk about current considerations. System of Care is a set of practices, principles, and resources that are associated with the 1995 legal settlement agreement between the Juvenile Rights Project here in Oregon, the National Center for Youth Law out of California, and the Department of Human Services.
Can I just talk for a minute? Well, Senator Morse is new, and I don't know whether the two gentlemen on the left are new to this committee at work at all, but would you kind of tell them what brought about the Juvenile Rights? You know,
Thank you.
Do you already know that?
Well, you know, I was writing down the question. What was the necessity for the...
Thank you. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I'm going to touch on that as I move forward a little bit. And then if there are any questions, please feel free if I need to clarify.
Thank you.
Essentially, the Juvenile Rights Project, the National Center for Youth Law, and another legal group out of Portland, Multnomah County, which eventually dropped itself from... potential litigation in 1992-93, had major concerns about the quality of case planning and the services that were provided to children in the foster care system here in Oregon, as well as the fact that services did not address children's individualized needs. Essentially, they looked to the fact that we had more or less a boilerplate set of services and resources available to youngsters, and that we did not focus on children's needs, on the strengths of their parents to address those needs, and on changes in the capacity of parents to take corrective action so that they could address future risk for their own children in their home. In very briefly, in 1993, there was an accord that was reached that allowed a work group to develop on a voluntary basis that engaged a large number of stakeholders from around the state, as well as the Juvenile Rights Project, and through their contact, the National Center for Youth Law, to take a look at what the systems reforms for practices, structures, and resources needed to be in order to address those concerns. Between 1993 and 1995, that work group met. They developed a draft proposal or set of recommendations for the state. Those recommendations went back out to stakeholders broadly across the state. They went to the legislature. Out of that set of recommendations, which is known as the recommendations of the work group, the state and the Juvenile Rights Project and the National Center for Youth Law agreed to enter into a voluntary settlement agreement as opposed to moving to a court process, which would have been very costly litigation. At that point in time, some 27 other states had gone through a similar process, and Oregon, to the best of my knowledge, as I understand it, was the first state to be able to enter into a voluntary settlement agreement, thus being able to move resources in that, as a result of the agreement, directly to meet the needs of children, as opposed to going into litigation. So that's a little bit of the history. System of care, and I will talk about case planning and what system of care is as I move forward. System of care case planning is based on, and I am now speaking, and I apologize, page 73, 473. System of care case planning is based on the identification of specific needs of individual children and the capacity to meet those needs. The model provides an interdisciplinary approach to crafting service plans that address the needs of children. Ideally, as caseworkers work with parents using the practice and resources associated with the model, parents should over time be able to demonstrate earlier compliance with case plans. We should be able to move children more quickly to reunification or to permanency, and parents should have improved capacity to address when their children are at risk of being re-abused. The department, as I mentioned, avoided potentially costly litigation by entering into the what has been an 8-year agreement, and we are in the closing months of that initial agreement. There have been amendments each biennium to the agreement that reflect changing practices, changing federal law, changing state law. So the agreement has, again, on a strictly voluntary nature, been a fluid document that has allowed us to work with the advocates for children, advocates being the Juvenile Rights Project primarily, to address continuing change in our systems. The agreement, in fact, as you just heard from Tony Peterson, about the changes in Child Protective Services, we're currently renegotiating, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes, a new agreement, and certainly those changes will be incorporated into that to make sure that we are looking at a comprehensive systems approach for working with children and families. Child welfare field offices have phased in implementation of the agreement over 4 biennia, and they've collaborated with key community partners to develop and apply comprehensive implementation plans that reflect community culture, community demographics, reflect the available resources in those communities, that reflect the input of stakeholders in those communities, and that reflect input from parents who've been actively encouraged to participate in the planning process for local implementation. Phase 4, which is the current phase in, has partially progressed through its first biennium of reforms, and a system of care practices and strengths needs-based philosophy, which is the approach to looking at parents' family strengths and children's needs, has evolved to become the foundation of child welfare practice in Oregon, and it fully supports compliance with federal child welfare outcomes. The original primary goals for system of care continue to serve as a foundation for achievement of best practice here in Oregon for safety, permanency, and well-being needs. And very quickly, those are strength needs-based practice as a center for our overall child welfare practice, practices and systems in place that support child safety, permanency, and well-being across the life of every case, the provision of services to children and families by well-trained staff with the capacity to work more extensively with families than they have in the past, and to know the children on their caseloads and their support systems in the community. And then finally, community investment in what we're calling a continuum of care for children in each county, built for children in partnership, again, with local stakeholders. That's very, very critical to successful implementation. I'm on 474 now. I'd like to talk about outcomes. System of care strengthens the department's ability to address the needs of abused and neglected children and their families. All of the federal child welfare performance measures can be linked directly to system of care practice and resources and that are intended to increase safety, permanency, and well-being. There are eight
programs.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I have a a sophomore 101 question. The department's commitment is to abused and neglected children. What about children that are victims or are third parties to a crime? Witness a crime. Let me just run a quick scenario by you really quick. I had a constituent contact me, 14-year-old daughter, ends up receiving a subpoena from the district attorney, not the parent, but the child. The child's been subpoenaed to go to court. I was asked to call the district attorney. I called the district attorney and said, why wasn't the parent notified? We're under no obligation to notify the parent. The daughter is very scared, does not want to go to court, does not want to see the person who perpetrated the crime. District attorney is saying, you will be there. Parents saying, I would like my child to be closed caption TV, something. Is there any, does this department in any way help those type of people who are not abused or neglected, however are, but are in a situation where they're intimidated, harassed, scared?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, what I can tell you is that routinely that would not fall within our mandate. However, in many communities, district attorney's offices work very closely with our local child welfare staff and ask us for consultation and support in those kinds of situations.
So I guess follow-up just really quick. I know time's late. I guess, you know, one thing this committee ought to be thinking about is, you know, children witness a lot of activity in which in the home is detrimental, mm-hmm. and yet it sounds like we don't have protections in place to protect these children when they witness something outside of the home that's still just as detrimental.
And Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I think we would share your concern about that.
But I would also point out, I'm very mindful that the agency as well as this panel will have to deal with these issues on a priority basis, Representative Smith, and I just ask Sheila, because last session we were able to fund system of care at, I believe, $17 million. If you look at the budget figure for this biennium, it's nowhere near the level that the agency needs in order to actually carry out its current functions and responsibilities. So I think we have to keep those in mind when we're deliberating on these budgets.
All about money.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, as I was beginning to go into outcomes, do an overview, there are eight programmatic goals for the System of Care program, six of which directly correlate to the federal outcomes, and those include keeping children safe through effective interventions, keeping children safe in their own homes, preserving or restoring family integrity through culturally responsive and individualized services, placement of children who are unable to remain in their home in settings that provide continuity with their extended families and parents, and then expediting safe, permanent homes for children who are unable to reunite with their birth families. There have been several studies of the effectiveness of strength needs-based practice that, and the use of flexible funds that actually have concluded in the current biennium. The Portland State University Child Welfare Partnership completed several evaluations specific to system of care, and these have included a 5-year study of strength needs-based services that concluded most caseworkers are, in fact, using a more collaborative approach with families, and that positive change has been evident with the majority of families receiving services through this model. That study also concluded that families can be served effectively by this approach, and that more information is available to caseworkers, about children's needs through collaborative processes with parents, and that families and caseworkers were more satisfied with the process and that flexible funds made it possible to address children's real needs. The second grouping of reports that Portland State University has concluded in the current biennium include branch-specific reports that examine the most effective use of flexible funds. And those focus studies generally found a high correlation between flex fund use and three of our federal review outcome measurements. And those include the fact that children are maintained safely in their own homes, that the continuity of family relationships and connections are preserved for children, and that families and caretakers have enhanced capacity to provide for their children's needs. In December of 2002, the Title IV-E waiver demonstration project evaluation 6-month progress report documented the impact of both the 4E waiver funds and system of care flexible funds on two federal and state performance measurements. Portland State's Child Welfare Partnership study is conducted on an ongoing basis, and the most recent research findings from that study note a significant positive impact of the provision of flexibly funded services on the percentage of children who are not subject to repeat maltreatment, the decreased length of stay in foster care for children, and the increased likelihood that youngsters will return to their original caretaker. I can either, at this point, Madam Chair, move into the next section, which would be to talk about the elements of the agreement that we're carrying forward.
Yes, I've asked Sheila to make the report available so that if any of the members want some detailed information with respect to the report, that they can review that.
Okay, great. And the Ways and Means document, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that speaks to that section begins on page 76 and talks about system of care elements. I'm going to move then to page 78 in this portion of the document and talk about, as quickly as I can, the current considerations.
Go ahead.
Unless you would like me to come back tomorrow.
No, I think we can complete this. Okay. I think the only question that I would have is that, and I noted that the agreement with the Juvenile Rights Project, that they're saying that we have not quite fully achieved, they don't think we'll achieve the obligations by June 30th, 03. What has been your conversation with them?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we have been in direct conversation with the Juvenile Rights Project about the fact that both the Juvenile Rights Project and the Department understand that we will not be in full compliance with the current agreement by the end of this biennium. We have initiated the conversation to renegotiate a new agreement into the next biennium. That is something the Juvenile Rights Project has agreed to. I think certainly the issue that looms is the fact that certainly always there is the potential for renewed interest in litigation on the part of the advocates, the Juvenile Rights Project, and the National Center for Youth Law. At this point in time, again, we're in a very amenable, voluntary discussion with them about how best to continue to forward the practices of system of care, potentially with diminished resources. We understand, and they understand, that this is the core of our practice, and the practice and the services certainly have provided very effective tools with which to address children and families. However, we also understand that with the loss specifically of the flex funds, that we have markedly diminished the capacity to provide for individualized services for youngsters, and that is something that the Juvenile Rights Project is very concerned about.
Have you, over time, been able to categorize under the use of the flex funds where the majority of that is going to, so that you can say that it's these were some of the specific needs? Are they so broad that you can't really identify them?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we've done some considerable work this biennium to begin to try to categorize flex funds to be able to provide that information. And we know that the vast majority of flexible dollars have gone into services such as behavioral supports in order to maintain difficult children in their own homes, parent coaching, mentoring, skill building for parents, mentoring and skill building for youngsters, supportive services, supportive therapeutic services, to include some assessments and services for health, mental health, dental needs that are not provided by any other resource, and purchase goods up front when we have exhausted other resources that the department can offer, such as prevention of foster care funds, to provide services and goods for families in order to prevent placement in foster care to begin with and to affect safety plans.
Could you provide me with a list or that particular document or report?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'd be glad to provide you with the information that we have.
Thank you. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Chair has asked the questions I really want answered the most. When we sat a few weeks ago trying to decide how to balance the budget, system of care was discussed, and it was difficult to tell what exactly the money was going for and what was being done with it. You mentioned goods for families. That doesn't tell me much. It meant, parenting skills. It doesn't tell me much. I'd like some specifics on where that money is going and how it's being used. It may be to extremely good causes, in which case we may have made a terrible error of the cuts we suggested. But we just don't know. And when I read through this material, it's so bland and so nonspecific, it's meaningless to me. And I really want to know more about your program, what's going on. I spent a couple of days, as Ramona knows, in our county going through the protective services for children and walked through the buildings and met the workers and talked to one family. And plus my experience of dealing with those families over 25 years. And I have real concerns about this entire program. And the biggest concern I have is that your major thrust is to put those kids back on those families and try to repair those families. Having watched three generations of this, I have concerns about those families are going to be repaired and whether our role should be to put those kids in safe environments that does not necessarily include their families. And that's sort of a little truth that nobody wants to admit to, nobody wants to talk about. So I really want to see where this is going and how it's going and see if we really are able to repair families. Madam Chair, a second question. I have to be in committee at 3 and everybody else does too, so we're squeezing a lot in. I'd like to know how many FTEs you have at the state level in this program, not in the county level, but the state level. If you can give me that at a later time, I'd appreciate it. I'm going to stop there. I have lots of other questions, but we're running out of time.
I might put some little sideboards around the last piece, because the agency under statute has responsibility as their first priority to try to reunite the families. That's their first priority, to do whatever possible that they can before they move into termination or freeing the children up for permanent placement. So since I was the person who had freeing children for permanent placement back in 1970s, and since then it has been even more of a mandate to states through the federal statute. So Dr. Bates, that's just one piece that we have to consider when we're talking about this, that it's the government that says we're not going to take away the rights of parents. We're going to try to make sure that we work with parents so that they can assume their own responsibility before we move towards terminating their rights. So,
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. And if you get that information to us, the one that was requested by Dr. Bates, and specifically what flex funds purchased. I do know in my county my judges were having a fit last session when they didn't think they were going to have their flex funds in order to address some of the issues, and also that their belief that system of care works because by bringing all of it to bear, that you are being able to put families back together. So I guess on one side you have one equation that's questionable, and on the other the courts are saying that they really like system of care. But which, by the way, I do want to put on the record, because at that meeting that you and I were at, the individual threw out that there was $300 million in system of care. There is not, I repeat, there is not $300 million in system of care. last year, biennium, I think we had 17, and the governor's budget now has what?
Five.
Five. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
So we have moved from 17 to 5. Is no further questions and no other acronyms today?
There's
oh, good.
15 for the pig.
Good, Rosie. We are adjourned. Until tomorrow.